It's Sunday morning. Time for the Great Outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter here on WGN Radio. And hope you very much enjoy the show this morning on the last Sunday of July, which means we're getting very close to the report from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Canadian Wildlife Service on population breeding ground surveys for the summer, which will tell us what kind of a fall flight of migratory birds we're going to have. Particularly, it focuses on waterfowl. But we got an advanced look on July 3rd, and I have been covering this for a lot of years. Bill Cullerton covered it before me. So for those of you on the Great Outdoors Show for at least the last 35 years, you've heard either Bill or me talk about the breeding ground surveys because they're basically to tell us, give us the information as to how we're doing. We're not doing very well, I'm afraid to say, and I don't want to start the show on a down note, but I have to report the facts as provided in the first look at the field waterfowl breeding population and habitat survey. Headline, North and South Dakota. The Dakotas were extremely dry this year, and we expect to see poor production overall from the region. Southern Manitoba is dry, and a warm winter provided little snow cover, and there's been below levels precipitation since then. We expect waterfowl production to be poor over much of the region. Northern Manitoba, Northern Montana, and Southern Alberta. Conditions are much drier than they have been in recent years, with many wetlands that go dry later in the summer being dry during breeding conditions. I could go on. And the most important area for breeding waterfowl is Southern Saskatchewan. And the headline is, we arrived in southern Saskatchewan grasslands to conduct our surveys to the bleakest conditions, if you are a duck. So all across the prairies, the words are, it's a bad year. And so with that, we will in the next week or so receive the breeding ground surveys of populations, but the habitat, you can't have good populations if you have lousy habitat. And this includes all the way up into the Yukon and Alaska, where apparently conditions were not good. It's as widespread poor conditions as I can recall going back to the early 1990s. What's going to be a challenge for the Fish and Wildlife Service is that they do things very differently than we did in the early 1990s, or actually for the previous 50 years prior to that. And that is, the seasons were always set, regulations were based upon that year's population. That changed a number of years ago under what they call adaptive harvest management, where seasons are set for many years at a time. However, with that being said, if we get the kind of numbers that some people feel we might get, it is going to cause great consternation as to whether adaptive harvest management can continue to go on with population levels that are likely to be the lowest they've been in close to 35 or 40 years. We are in a situation that looks perilously like the mid-1980s when we had to drastically reduce bag limits and season lengths. So the seasons have been set for this fall, which includes an increase in the bag limit from pintail from one a day, which has been for a number of years, to three. We talked about that on a show earlier this year. When they find out we may have a record low number of pintail in the breeding grounds, there will be a revisit of that going from one to three. I'm certain they'll be revisited. I'm not sure it'll be changed because the pressures to keep it at the newly announced three birds a day will be extreme. But overall, if this does not turn around, and we know it can turn around quickly, all it needs to do is get a lot of snow and water on the prairies, but the prairies go through prolonged drought periods. They have since the evolution began. and this is no exception. But we also, on our end, have to adapt. And right now, the Fish and Wildlife Service is not projecting a change this fall. Once the numbers come in, we'll see what they do. But my guess, for those of you listening, is there will be no change from the regulations they have proposed. They will continue forward, and they'll say, we'll evaluate this, and if need be, we'll make changes in the future. I could argue, having been at this a long time, that's not the best management practice. We have a near-term situation that could cause us to be far more conservative in what takes place as far as 100 days and harvest. And the Fish and Wildlife Service will be under pressure to take that into consideration. But they have embraced this adaptive harvest management plan, which calls for setting seasons and regulations many years in advance and following through. So that's the report from the prairies. I will have more soon. But for those of you who could care less about waterfowl but simply love to watch the migration of birds, watch the migration of songbirds, etc., the vast majority of birds passing through the Midwest all come from the prairies. Your migratory birds all come from the prairies, majority of them. And they are having a terrible year. So for bird watchers who want to go out and see the southward migration, the great migration in the fall, and who want to see robins or sparrows or anything else fly by, bobolinks, etc., it's just not going to be a great year. So let me move from that to a subject that came up recently, and that was a discussion I had last week, and I'm going to just touch on it now before I go to break, but when I come back, I will dive into it further. And I mentioned last week on the discussion of the third rail, you know, the conversation of, do we have too many people trying to use too few resources, in this case, too many people trying to enjoy America's great outdoors. And a listener wrote me and said, can you talk about the difference between private lands and public lands management and why it seems like private lands are so much better managed than public lands? I'm happy to do that when I come back from the break. And then I'm also going to talk about an individual who was really at the forefront of conservation efforts in the state of Montana, who recently passed away, a great guy. And I'm just going to mention, you won't know him by name, Ted Watson, but you may understand and appreciate how people like him made such a difference for the betterment of our world. I'll be back in just a moment with much more on the great outdoors. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN, and first a message from our longtime sponsors at Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
Hiking, camping, and hunting, it's all an adventure in the great outdoors, but nature can be tough. You need to be ready for anything and everything. Chevy Silverado is built to handle the toughest conditions and get you everywhere you want to go worry-free. Silverado's designed to handle the big jobs. It's built for the great outdoors. With over 13,000 pounds of towing capacity and trailering sway control, Silverado can haul the biggest loads on the roughest roads and keep you cool as a Sunday drive. With 8 available cameras and up to 14 different views, it can spot trouble before it gets to you. That's peace of mind. And when you're ready for the backcountry, Chevy Silverado 1500 ZR2 owns the off-road. You name it, we run over it. No wonder it's Motor Trend's 2023 four-wheeler pickup truck of the year. So see your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer or go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and check out a Chevy Silverado. It's freedom to explore the great outdoors.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. And the question last came in from a listener. Why does it seem like private lands are better managed than public lands? That's a broad brush. There obviously are exceptions to the rule, but in fact, that question is really not so much a question as a reality. Private lands are better managed than public lands. And there are lots of reasons for that. But I would offer that one of the things we need to look at is what's happening in forest fires. And why is it that these horrible forest fires that are taking place and have been taking place. Really, 1988 and Yellowstone fires were the beginning of what has been now nearly 40 years of, by and large, pretty bad fire seasons, and yet only a small percentage of the landscape that can burn in the American West and Canada has burned. That's not a good omen. But of the land that's burned in forest fires over the past 40 years, the overwhelming majority is public lands. It's not private lands. Why is that? It's because private lands are managed by the individuals who own them, who have an economic or otherwise vested interest, recreational or familiar, family, whatever it might be, into making sure that property is managed. So if you're a company like Sierra Pacific and you own 2 million acres in the Northern California and into Southern Oregon, and it burns, you're done. You're out of business forever. Your company shuts down. So their forests are managed so that they don't have fires. And when there are fires in the adjoining forests of the U.S. Forest Service, those fires tend to stay on Forest Service land. Yes, some lands definitely burn if the fire is big enough, but by and large, the fuel for fires exists in the lands that aren't being managed, where disease and dead trees lay on the ground or stand in the air if you're a diseased tree or dead tree as well, and it just serves as an inferno. So if you think about the management picture, and it comes back to what I talked about last week about maybe too many of us trying to enjoy the great outdoors, the capacity to enjoy the great outdoors is in large part reliant on the production capacity of a landscape. If you have trails well-maintained, they can handle more people. If you are managing property for the abundance of wildlife, it will have more wildlife. It's very simple. Why is it that duck hunting, for instance, is better on private lands than it is on public lands? It has to do a lot with management. Locations are often the same. They're right next to each other. They're interspersed, but the management's very different. Our forest management is tremendously different. And when you look at northern Wisconsin and Minnesota and Michigan with their huge expanse of private and public forests, pretty certain the private forests are going to have more wildlife. They're going to be better managed. They're going to have fewer diseased trees. They're going to have fewer fires. And all that's because the private individual has a vested interest, a vested self-interest. And self-interest is a high motivating factor, as a friend of mine often points out. So if it's federally owned, it belongs to all of us, but it doesn't belong to, if you think about it, specifically any of us. We all care about our federal lands, but none of us are empowered individually to do anything about managing our federal lands or our state lands. In Illinois, think of all of our state parks, and you go to a state park and you think, gosh, this could be done better, or that could be done better, or why haven't they done this? We are owners of that state park, but we are not individually responsible for that state park's management. And so there is the reason that when the question is asked, why are private lands so much more productive by and large than federal lands or state lands? It's because singular individuals are charged with their responsibly managing those lands for not the public good, for their own good. And in the case of our state parks and federal lands, individuals are charged with managing them, but their budgets come from somewhere else, and those lands belong to all of us. So at the end of the day, if management doesn't go well, is that person out of a job? Not likely. If a forest burns down, if a U.S. forest burns down in a certain place in America, that forest still belongs to all of us. The trees just aren't there anymore, but they're not out of business. If that forest burns down and belongs to a private landowner, they're out of business. So there's the real difference. My opinion, at least, the real difference. Ted Watson. I'm just going to mention for a little bit of time I have left, Ted Watson was an outdoorsman extraordinaire, angler, hunter, sportsman, who was a famous model before he decided he'd rather look at the Rocky Mountains of Montana than look at light bulbs going off in studios in in Madison Avenue in New York, and he moved to Montana nearly, well, gosh, 1962, so a long time ago. And he passed away last week, but he left an indelible impression on the future of Montana. And here's one of the ways he did. You all recall the film, A River Runs Through It? They made the film, but there were no fish to be caught in the film. The producers of the film hadn't actually thought, oh my gosh, we got to have some fish to catch. It was Ted Watson, little known fact. You win this in a trivia contest. It was Ted Watson who provided the fish to be caught in A River Runs Through It from his fishing lakes on his ranch. He brought them into the set, and they used those fish in A River Runs Through It. He was a great conservationist and did a lot for the future of the state of Montana and the American West through private management and his actions to make our place a better world. Thanks so much for listening. Next week when I talk to you, I'll actually be talking to you from Juneau, Alaska, as I will be doing some work for the Great Outdoors Show, and I look forward to speaking with you from there. Have a great week in the great outdoors. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.